one of our very important chronological members that is arriving, so we have a quorum this morning. I am opening up the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services. It is June 14th, and are we getting through this month very, very rapidly? It's work session on Senate Bill 512 relating to nursing homes. Mr. Britton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. We had a public hearing on Senate Bill 512 yesterday, and this was after the senators had to leave, so we were not able to complete a work session on it. We want to finish that up today if we can. Senate Bill 512 is a bill that would allow SDSD, or would direct SDSD, to establish a demonstration project to evaluate alternative approaches to licensing and regulating nursing homes. It requires SDSC to apply for a waiver from HICPA for this project and to write implementation rules. The bill imposes a $6.50 a bed annual fee on nursing facilities to pay the state portion of the project cost. The bill establishes a senior consumer advisory committee to assess the implementation of the demonstration project. And because this is a demonstration project, or to make it a demonstration project, the bill would sunset on June 30th, 2005. The project would allow SDSD to inspect or survey nursing facilities more often or less often, depending on their judgment about those facilities. And the project would have SDSD provide more training and consultation with nursing facility staff.
With that, I'll turn it back to you. And we did discuss this yesterday, and we did not have a quorum in order to act on it. And I think I made the point yesterday that this is similar to what we, a bill we passed on OSHA last session that allowed them to look at those facilities that were having trouble and those who were not having trouble, so that we're not really utilizing resources in an area that we didn't need to. And I also noted that the industry itself has done self-imposing of the fees in order to pay for this. So I think that's a good thing. Representative Schrader.
I have a question.
I apologize
for missing some of this yesterday, but it seems like we already have kind of like a long-term care ombudsperson that would be doing, I think, some of this, and disabilities type commissions, and we have the nursing home administrator review board. I guess I'm not totally clear on why we're doing this.
Mr. Carlson, would you come forward?
It's regular.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Carlson, representing Oregon Healthcare Association. Federal nursing home survey and enforcement standards and regulations are in federal law, and they are federal requirements. And Senior Disabled Services Division is the state unit that provides the services for the federal government. What this would do would be to allow them more flexibility under federal laws to allocate resources towards quality improvement activities, and really focusing a lot of their survey activities on facilities that have the greatest need, and for facilities that have had ongoing records, strong performance, and whose quality indicators that are being monitored on an ongoing basis would merit it, would have longer intervals between surveys.
Why aren't they doing that now?
Federal law prohibits it.
Not allowed to inspect?
No. Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, they do inspect on a very rigid schedule imposed under federal law. They are not allowed to depart from those federal requirements. With the new Secretary of Health and Human Services and the new head of the Health Care Financing Administration, they have both endorsed the concept of staggered survey intervals, and it is going to take a change in federal policy to allow states to implement this type of an approach.
Madam Chair.
Representative Schrader, no.
So then why do we need the $6 fee?
Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, the state is estimating that it would take an additional, I can't recall if it was 3 or 4 FTEs to implement and study and evaluate the demonstration project. We're looking to actually measure how quality and resident outcomes look under this alternative survey process as opposed to the current one, so there's an evaluation piece. The voluntary fees from the providers would fund those positions. Most of the money is federal, but the fee increases would fund the general fund portion.
I don't see why they need any FTE to do it. The idea is good. I like the idea. I don't see why they need any FTE to do this. It seems silly. I'm sorry. I mean, it doesn't seem necessary.
The FTE is not a part of this package.
I assume that's what the $6 is going for, eh?
It requires 4 positions and 3 FTE.
If I might, Madam Chair, if you look at on the fiscal analysis of this, what the FTEs would be going for is they'll be conducting pre-survey quality consultations with the providers, post-survey quality consultations. They'll also be convening what they're calling regional peer-sharing forums with providers on quality improvement activities. And the state has estimated that it's going to take more surveyor hours to conduct some of those activities as part of the demonstration.
Representative Patridge.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is trying to be a PERLA. You weren't here for the hearings yesterday, but I thought the best analogy that was given yesterday was what we do with OSHA inspections, in that now the surveyors are going to come in and give recommendations and advice, rather than use kind of a carrot approach as opposed to a stick approach that's basically used now. I thought probably that was the best analogy that Jim gave yesterday. And in doing that, that's obviously going to take some time, but we're hoping that the association and the department are hoping that that's going to improve the quality of care. We're trying to be proactive about it, and I think that that's going to take some time.
Policy sounds good.
Senator Yee?
Well, my question is, why does it take 4 positions and 3 FTEs? I understand you need to do training and consultation. I think that.
Mm-hmm.
But does it take 4 positions?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, when we worked on bringing the legislation this session, we spent quite a bit of time with Dan Barker, the manager of SDSD's Nursing Facility Survey Program, and they did some pretty detailed estimates of the number of hours this was going to take. We were very careful and went over those estimates very carefully because we did not want to fund out of the pockets of our members the costs if we felt that they were unnecessary or unreasonable. And so we did work with them pretty closely on their estimates and felt that they were reasonable estimates as we went through the numbers.
Mr. Kaplan, question, because I have to share the concern of the FTE issue and would like to have a response from you whether or not do you think that it could be 2 instead of 3? Or,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dan Kaplan, Deputy Administrator of Senior and Disabled Services. When we put together the fiscal analysis, obviously we had to make a plan to operationalize the language of the proposed bill. And we went through that and estimated that the time would have to be spent on quality improvement training done throughout the state. The most substantial time impact would be for on-site consultations. And to do on-site consultations, workers really need to sit down with information about the facility and quality outcomes in the facility. And through a federally prescribed data collection tool called Minimum Data Sets, there is really fairly comprehensive data on the on the physical status, mental status, and care outcomes of clients in nursing facilities now. And so part of preparation for consultation is evaluating those data and identifying where there may be systemic weaknesses in the facility. So there's a lot of work associated with that and sitting down with the facility and working on.
Like, do you currently do consultation?
We do not.
So this would be a new...
would be a new workload. The other thing I should mention is that although...
But is there a reason why you're not doing currently doing any consultation?
It's a matter of the resources we have available. We are barely able to keep up with a federally required inspection schedule now. We do keep up with it, but it's very close.
So when you do an inspection now, you do not also do consultation once you have inspected the facility? What's the process now?
Madam Chair, that's correct. In fact, there is one of the concerns around this particular demonstration is that people who do survey and certification work are really required to follow a very closely prescribed set of rules in how they do the survey. And it is, in fact, a rigorous enforcement kind of survey. Consultation is meant to be something different, and it is meant to be something where cooperatively people from the regulatory agency and from individual nursing facilities sit down and look at their data and attempt to really be very clear on problems in operations and ways of fixing those problems. This is not something that we have typically done. We believe it's a good idea, but it's not something we've typically done. And in looking for a waiver from the federal requirements, we do not believe that we can get a waiver which substitutes this sort of consultation work for rigorous enforcement work. We believe that what we're really asking for is a waiver that allows us to inspect on a different schedule from the one that we are required to do now. Now we're required to use a once in 12 month schedule, and we need a waiver to do fewer inspections in facilities that are operating well and more in facilities that are not operating. So that's what the waiver is about. But the consultation work is in addition.
Madam Chair, this sounds to me very, very similar to the changes we made at the hospitals with the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Hospitals, where we went from rigid annual or semi-annual visits to where you could get a situation occurring where you wouldn't have to have a visit for 3 years, potentially, if you did well. If you had trouble, they'd come back the next year and work with you. And they also moved away from just having a check-off list of you made it or didn't make it and started having an opportunity to look at quality improvement in the hospitals, and they did make a difference that way. We also, though, I think, had to fund some of that ourselves. You know, the joint credit, the joint conference is paid for by the hospitals themselves, and that federal funds, mandates involved in it, of course, because you have to get your accreditation to get your Medicaid funds and your Medicare funds, which are the more important ones for hospitals. Is this a similar program? This similar kind of change you're looking at that we went through in the last 6-7 years with the Joint Commission?
Madam Chair,
if you don't know,
it's Representative Bates. I wouldn't say that it's modeled on that necessarily. I would say, though, that this is a change in introducing consultation that the industry sees an interest in itself, and I think that's why they're willing to pony up the cost of the extra consultation.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, if I might, we very much would like to change the culture of the survey and enforcement process that's very prescriptive at the federal level. And in order to get the Healthcare Financing Administration to allow Oregon to really be one of the first states to try some things differently, we felt that we had to build in very clearly the consultative aspects, some of these quality improvement activity and training activities, because the feds aren't going to do this without a lot of scrutiny at the federal level. And a number of other states have tried at the tail end of the last administration unsuccessfully to get approval to implement alternative survey processes. And so we've been working for over the last 2 years with Senior Disabled Services Division staff We've had discussions with members of Oregon's congressional delegation around the proposal, as well as at the HCFA regional level with the other states in the region. And I think that the other states in the region and HCFA's regional office all believe that this type of an approach is better than the very prescriptive federal approach we have today. But we're going to need to have some things built into this on a demonstration project level to be able to garner federal approval.
Follow up,
Yeah, Madam Chair, one last follow up. The FDA you're talking about, I'm going to make an assumption. Tell me if it's wrong. Let's say a facility doesn't do well on their survey. Would those people come back in then and work with them on a consulting base to show them best practices from other facilities and really be in there to help them, or are they going to just be out there preparing them for the next survey?
If I might, Dan, jump in. What part of this is that right now you have one snapshot in time survey, and they come in and go through a pretty intensive process. There will be a pre-survey consultation that's technical assistance, quality improvement oriented. Then post-survey, there will be another post-survey that's a technical assistance consultative visit. The actual survey itself will not change when that occurs. Or if there is a complaint survey or a quality of care issue that becomes apparent, the surveyors will come in and take immediate action if necessary. But we wrap around the traditional survey to quality improvement consultations. You will have a different team of surveyors come in and do the actual survey from the surveyors who are working with you on the quality improvement activities, so that you kind of keep that firewall, if you will, between the surveyors who will be doing your annual survey and those who are working with you on an ongoing basis on quality improvement activities.
Senator, you
have another question. So, Jim, is a long-term goal to convince federal government that this many surveys are not necessary for the ones who are performing well, and the ones who are not performing well will increase the inspections?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, that's one of the goals. The other goal, I think, is to convince the federal government that we need to change the focus to actually improving the care and the services and the outcomes to residents, and to move away from kind of what Representative Bates was describing as this kind of prescriptive checklist, paper chart kind of review. Let's take a look at actual health outcomes, health status, other quality indicators that are more meaningful, and let's see if we can improve the actual care and services to individuals instead of just having this kind of paperwork compliance with some very prescriptive standards.
Mm-hmm. So, follow up. So, the overall care for the long-term care nursing homes will increase.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, that is our hope. A lot of times, Congress in particular and the federal government, right, it's really easy to sit back and throw a new mountain of federal regs on and pretend that's going to somehow improve quality of care. We've taken a little bit different tact and say we think it depends on resources, training, giving people the tools they need to successfully meet the needs of the folks they serve. And so we're trying to really, I think, change the culture and the approach to how we measure quality in nursing homes.
One more follow-up. Will you be able to give us the quality of care of nursing homes now from your performance indicators? Give us a list, one-page list of the priority concerns and priority indicators at the beginning of the biennium. And at the end of the biennium, give us another one-page report so we can see whether, in fact, the pilot program has improved quality of care for the industry.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, as part of this project, what we will do is we will sit down and develop a list of key indicators, and those are indicators that we'll have baseline data on and we'll be able to track over time to see how this intervention changes.
But we don't want the only five or six priority issues.
We can do that.
Ahead and move this. We can discuss the issue of FTE when we review the agency's budget. But Representative Patridge.
Madam Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 5.
If I might, there is one amendment, technical amendment.
Yeah.
Yes, and the amendment was handed out yesterday to all of you. It amends, as I recall, trying to...
Is it the day 7?
Want me to do it?
Yes.
That's day 7?
Right. Yeah, that's it.
What, if I might, Madam Chair, what it does is...
Page 2 of the A engrossed bill on line 3. It says, right now, conduct additional licensing surveys under the following circumstances. This would be conduct additional licensing surveys as needed, including but not limited to the following circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the A7 amendment.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'd move the dash A7 amendments to Senate Bill 512.
Representative Patrick moves the dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 512. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So I will note that Representative Schrader is an objection. Representative Patridge.
Madam Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 512 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Patridge moves Senate Bill 512 with the dash amendments to the full Ways and Means with the due pass recommendation. Is there any objection? Representative Schrader, note that he is an objection. Representative Patrick, would you like to carry it to floor?
Yeah. Madam Chair?
Senator
Just coming from another meeting. May I be recorded?
Yes. Senator Duncan is recorded as an I vote on Senate Bill 12 as a member.
Now, do you want to ask the Senate again right here?
Judicial. Would you like to carry it in the Senate? Yes, right. And we can carry it always. We'll close Senate Bill 512 and open for House Bill 3996.
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 3996 is a bill that would transfer $2 million, and that is an amendment, that's the dash one amendment that you have before you, from the law enforcement medical liability account into the general fund. The law enforcement medical liability account is located within the Adult and Family Services Division of the Department of Human Services. I've handed out the kind of the financial flow, the revenues and expenditures, and ongoing balance for the current biennium to show you that we have, or we expect to have, a fairly significant balance by the end of the biennium, about $2.9 million. We've had revenues in the current biennium of about $1.8 million, expenditures of about $440,000. The idea here is, as I said, to remove $2 million out of the balance and put it into the general fund. For a point of reference, you need to know that the expenditures in the 97-99 biennium were about $1.1 million, 95-97 about $800,000, 93-95 about $700,000. So it does bump around a little bit. This proposal would leave about between $800,000 and $900,000 in this particular account. It does nothing to curtail the flow of revenue into the account or necessarily the expenses to pay claims out of the account.
Representative Patrick.
John, because I've been working with the FAA,
right.
I haven't seen 5010. I know that it's still being worked on, but is that going to be reflected that we're going to downsize the amount of the payment? Representative Schrader and I got rolled on 2877.
My understanding from our LFO staff is that the CFAA bill does nothing to this particular revenue flow, or this revenue stream. And so our expectation is that the revenue for the upcoming biennium would be approximately what it is now, and that the claims we think we're safe, in other words, as far as the, being able to pay the claims that come into this account. We'll just,
any other questions? Representative Schrader.
Yes. Madam Chair, I'd like to move the dash one amendments delete the question mark dollars and insert $2 million into the line four of House Bill 3906.
Representative Schrader moves that we adopt the dash one amendments that insert $2 million to House Bill 3996. Is there any objection? Hearing none. Approved. Representative Schrader.
I'd like to move House Bill 3996 as amended to the Full Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Schrader moves House Bill 3996 as amended to the Full Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objection? Hearing none. So ordered.
Carriers, Madam.
Carrier, Representative Schrader.
Sure. And for the Senate.
Senator Duncan, would you like to carry this one for the Senate?
Sure.
Sure, he will.
Thank you. Such enthusiasm. Thank you very much. I think now we have Ms. Baker. To the seniors' chronological advantages down there this morning. I arrived early, so I went all the way, got up early enough to bake donuts.
Oh. Wow.
Thank goodness.
You baked.
I'm sure she did.
You make a donut? Since this is the Dole Committee. Yes.
Oh, yes.
An opening public hearing and work session on House Bill 2331, and we have with us David Foster and Lynn Parton. Are here? And Representative, do you want to go down and also?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Janet Carlson, District 32. House Bill 2331 raises the issue of asset development. And the importance of asset development in escaping poverty and building economic strength. A Washington University professor named Michael Sheridan wrote a book called Assets from the Poor. In that book, he argued that individuals do not escape poverty by spending, but by saving and investing. Our current welfare system really penalizes asset acquisition and savings by the poor. Our tax system, on the other hand, encourages asset building by people who are not poor. So he suggests in this book that we need some new policies to support asset development so families have an opportunity to save for their futures. People who accumulate assets change their thinking and their behavior. They're likely to take care of what they have, plan for the future, develop their personal capabilities, and participate in the community. So assets enable and empower families and individuals to plan, to make choices, to take responsibility for creating longer-term options for their future. And he also cites a couple of federal policies as examples, the Homestead Act, the GI Bill, which have been examples of where we've encouraged families to develop assets and escape poverty and build their futures. So in 1991, the Oregon Legislature passed Senate Bill 800, and that directed the Oregon Progress Board to design an individual children's development account. In 1993, and I think it became part of House Bill 2004 that created the state and local commissions, this became ORS 417-900. The concept behind the children's development accounts is that they'd be optional, individually owned, interest-bearing accounts, much like individual retirement accounts, with specific state tax benefits that could be used for college education, long-term training, business capitalization, or a first home purchase. The original design, as envisioned by the 93 legislature, is that there'd be about 10,000 accounts, that there'd be annual deposits of up to about $2,000, that the programs would be designed, managed, and carried out by community organizations, and that the state agency would do a competitive bid process looking at match and track record, that they would involve the community groups that would be the United Way, corporations, individuals, and foundations. So it was because of this vision that they put this program in the State Commission on Children and Families, because of that envisioned idea of having comprehensive planning and that local community groups would be involved with this. The program's been around then since 1991, when envisioned, and as a pilot since 1993, and on the statute books, but it has not been implemented by the State Commission on Children and Families. There was not any funding associated with the program, and the commission has really been focused on sort of other things, and they're here and can speak to that, but it doesn't fit within their mission as well as it might. So in looking at this program, and there was actually, I believe, an audit that Sheila is familiar with, it that highlighted the fact that the Children's Development Account had been on the books and really nothing had happened with it, the interim study.
Representative Carlson, a question, because yes. You mentioned that it doesn't fit within the mission of children and the Commission on Children and Families. How does this fit within the mission of housing and community development?
Well, that's where I'll get to it, okay? So we brought a bill forward to actually highlight the program. This was to the interim committee in November, and say that it needs to be funded or something needs to happen because nothing's being done with it. At that point, the committee said, well, why don't we move it to housing and community services, because the Oregon legislature in 1999 set up the individual development account program in housing and community services, which is a similar program but allows adults in poverty to set up similar accounts, so that this would in essence tag on to that program and expand it so that you could have families and children with accounts as well as adults. And so Bob Repine was at that meeting. He came forward, said, sure, we'd be happy to do that. So the amendment was drafted through the committee, and the committee bill that came forward to the legislature, rather than funding the program or terminating the program, actually moved it to housing and community services to be coordinated with the individual development account program. That was House Bill 3600 in the last session. I've had some discussions with David Foster and Lynn Parton, who are here from the agency, and they have told me that they did not get funding in the last session for the program either. They do have a bill that deals with the tax credit that actually has moved, I saw, this session. And so they've been using some federal funds within their agency to keep the program going, and they can speak to that. The other issue that we have discussed is that not only are there programs for asset development and housing and community services, but as you know, the State Treasurer's Office has some initiatives going. The Adult and Family Services Division has some training accounts that they've set up. Employment Department is working on some asset development initiatives. So everybody's thinking this is a good idea, and we have about four or five different agencies all starting to develop programs. Voc Rehab, I think, is one more that may not actually be coordinated together. So one of the issues that I wanted to raise with the committee is whether, if we decide that we're going to move 2331, that we could have some discussion around some future coordination of the programs. And that's why I proposed the I believe it's the sixth amendment that the chair and I discussed yesterday, which asks, is subject to funding for the Housing and Community Services Department to pull together some of these agencies that are implementing asset development programs, savings accounts, that type of thing, so that we can have better coordination.
I guess my question is that who should be the agency, and it seems like a real leap, and I would like to hear from the commission, if the commission is here.
If there are no further questions, I'll move back up.
Are there any further questions of Representative Carlson?
Then I can ask some questions, too.
For the record, my name is Mickey Lansing, Deputy Director of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the State Commission on Children and Families is, in fact, in favor of this piece of legislation, because when the individual development account was set up in our agency, we neither had the resources nor a mechanism by which we could create these individual development accounts. When Housing and Community Services, and I'm saying especially Community Services, looked at this issue last session, we were very supportive of them having this kind of, these kinds of accounts, and felt that it was within their mission and goals, since they, in fact, serve low-income people. And while we didn't say particularly low-income, we did talk about an eligibility criteria within our statute. And they have the ability, in working with community-based organizations, to access the tax credits and other kinds of mechanisms that can help in this particular way. So we felt it was really, this program was much more aligned with the kind of work they did in community as opposed to the work we do.
Madam Chair.
Representative Carlson.
If I could just emphasize, by community services portion, you're talking about the community action agencies
in RAC,
in the various areas of the state. Is that correct? That actually,
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, that is correct. And you see, community action agencies work with community development corporations who not only build affordable housing, but one of the issues with affordable housing is around sort of wrapping around social supports, making sure that families have access to other kinds of things within the community, et cetera. And so this just seemed to be a better fit for what Housing and Community Services is doing.
Representative Schroeder.
Has anyone tried to use this program?
Madam Chair, Representative Schroeder, no, they have not.
Oh, Representative Schroeder.
The other program, the Individual Development Account, has anyone used that program yet?
Madam Chair, I'm David Foster, Policy Strategist, Oregon Housing and Community Services, and I've been involved in asset building strategies for quite a few years. The HB 3600 was passed in 99 by the legislature. It was actually deployed about a year ago, and there are currently, I think, about 250 individuals who are participants in IDA programs in Oregon. There are a number of organizations involved. I want to say that there's about 13 organizations involved around the state, and we're taking a regional approach to bring together partners into a network regionally. And currently, the Portland metro area, Central Oregon, are operative. We've just funded through the tax credit program just in the past 2 weeks. Funded a program in the Douglas County area. Southern Oregon is getting organized, as well as Central, the Willamette Valley area. So the answer is yes.
What's the total asset? So you've got 250?
I'm sorry, I can't tell you the total amount, but I can tell you that the average savings that individuals put in on their own behalf is about $25 to $30 a month, which is typically matched by a $1 or $2 factor through the other assets that the community organizations bring to the equation. Typically, they strive for, depending on what they're aiming for, whether it's homeownership or education or whatever, they typically aim for $2,000 to $5,000 in total assets, and that's a typical figure nationally. So that can give you an indication of what we're after.
Any other questions? Senator Yee.
So if they have individual accounts, why can't it be deposited in a bank account in their name? Why does it have to be deposited with Commission for Children and Families, name goes to housing?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, it's actually a little more complicated than that. The partnership involves both a community-based organization that is already working with a family who is in poverty to deal with their issues, and the partnership invariably also includes a bank. And the accounts are actually established as parallel tracks. There's the monies that are this is getting fairly technical, and I'm not sure how much we need to get into this today, but the point
I
is...
I think for us to understand it, you need to get into the technicalities of it.
The funds that are traditionally with an IDA, the funds that are contributed by the individual are put into an account that is in their name. The funds that are provided as matching funds are put into a name and held in joint signatureship, so that the funds are actually only available to, if you're going to be using it for an educational experience, the funds are actually paid to the college or the institution that you're getting the education. But they're typically held in a bank or a credit union as an account. Washington Mutual has been the lead partner in the Portland area. In Central Oregon, I think Cascade Bank is the key partner with the partnership over there. The credit union, there's a credit union in Eugene that's very involved in championing these at this point. So to answer your question, the money actually ends up being being deposited into a financial institution, but the management of the funds is a partnership between the community-based organization, the financial institution, and the individual that's involved.
What's the follow-up?
I think you're making things very complicated because of this. If the individual can deposit their earnings or the money they save in their own individual bank account, and at the time of college, they can apply for funds from the Student Assistance Commission. That's a scholarship commission that they can apply for. Or somebody can contribute in their name to that commission. And at the college time, money can be sent to the college of their own selection. So why do we want to set up another account? I mean, if they want to purchase housing, department, and they have provisions to help first-time homeowner purchase programs. So I don't understand the need to set up another trust account for the individual. That can be done through education or through housing department.
You want to respond to that?
There's probably a couple of ways that we could respond to that. One is that the intention is that this be a pool of money that can be used for homeownership, education expenses, or starting up a small business. And it's intended to be one of the tools that the organization uses to help the family move out of poverty, along with other programs that are involved. So it's not just like you're setting up a savings account to do whatever you want to with those funds. The second part of the equation is that this affords a certain amount of credit accountability with the account in having the nonprofit organization involved to make sure that the funds actually get used the way that they were intended to be used. Yes, if an individual is in a position, and they're actually encouraged, there are individuals who are in IDA programs that go beyond the requirements of the IDA and put in $50 a month, even though they're only able to be matched for the $25 a month, for example, and they have a savings account separate that they're billing because, as Representative Carlson indicated, it changes the way that people think, and they begin to look forward and ahead to things. So I think those are the reasons. I would also add, in terms of the history of IDAs, IDAs were intended to be approving that with proper incentives, persons who are of low income can actually create assets just like the rest of us can. And so my expectation is to your point, that over time, IDAs will evolve into something much more straightforward, much more basic. In fact, there's a proposal in the Congress right now to create an account system that is basically done through tax law and banking provisions that completely takes out the social service side of the equation, the partnership dynamic. So I think over time, Senator Yee, it will evolve. Right now, the tools that we have nationally point to this kind of a structure, and we mirrored in the HB 3600 last session, we mirrored the national patterns that have been championed in Congress and so forth.
Representative Partridge.
I'm just wondering, when this was given originally and this bill passed, was there any money or FTE given to...
No.
Chair Winters and Representative Partridge, the answer to the question is no, and that has been the major stumbling block, I think, from the beginning, that it was a great concept that was supported by a number of people. It was originally placed in the Progress Board. The Progress Board, because there was no staffing, no funding, did nothing with it. I think the similar thing happened as it ended up in the Children and Families Commission. We likewise are nervous about taking on additional responsibility without any appropriate staffing or funding, but see that there is an opportunity here as you are willing to provide some funding to do some coordination of various efforts in state government on asset building.
And Representative Carlson.
I just wanted to point out that the amendments, there are several other amendments, you'll notice they say subject to available funding, so it doesn't obligate the agency to move forward. And there is some discussion about they would need $150,000, but we wouldn't be dealing with that right now. If there was money available at the end, it's possible that we could do that. But the idea here is just to simply get the program transferred and see how it can blend in and how it can coordinate with some of these other programs that are out there.
And if I may, I'm Lynn Parton with Housing and Community Services Department. And on the witness sign-up sheet, I checked neutral because there were a variety of amendments, possible, some of them outside of the governor's budget. And I checked neutral because I wasn't sure exactly what was going to be on the plate.
Yes.
But if, in fact, the Dash 6 amendments are the only things that are being considered today, we are in favor of those.
Madam Chair, if I could just add, then you would probably also need the
Representative Carlson.
Okay, you would probably also need the Dash 3 that say subject to available funding with the program.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, the Dash 6 amendments already say it's subject to available funding.
No. If I could, actually, that's in a different section, Lynn. You need both.
Okay.
I don't understand.
I'm good.
Just a comment, Madam Chair. I'm just a little concerned about that this is maybe not the proper division to have this. I understand the problems that have been with the commission deal. I'd almost... You know, it seems strange that the individual development account is actually in Housing and Community Services to me also. So I apologize for not being overly enthusiastic at this point. Probably a good idea, but I'm not sure that this is the place for this account.
Madam Chair, if I could respond to Representative Schrader, probably the reason that it ended up there is that I've been chief sponsor and advocate for asset building strategies for about 15 years. I've done significant writing on the material, won some awards and recognized and so forth. So it, in some part, it's probably simply because you have someone who's been interested in it for a long time.
Well, and Madam Chair, I could just respond to that too. I do think that there is validity in what Mickey talked about earlier, that community action agencies in communities are linked up with people in poverty. They see those people every day. Or if you put it in the treasurer's office, or if you put it somewhere where they would have to do a lot of outreach. I mean, the treasurer's office is one thing if you're having people who are trying to get the kids in college and they want to set up an account and they can pick up a brochure. But if you're dealing with people who are in poverty, there needs to be some nexus with a service that's being provided. And so Adult and Family Services has that nexus, but they don't deal with people on a long-term basis.
community action agencies are nonprofit. They deal with Head Start. They deal with a lot of other programs, and they don't just do housing and housing community services. They do housing and they do community services, and so it's that portion that I think is more appropriate for this particular.
I'm going to teach that, having been one of these individuals in this building, that whose spouse was the head of the State Economic Opportunity Office. Community action agencies are very good at working with the community at large. They are very good at not having to have full control of a program, but are able to network out to get others to do what they need to do for people that are in poverty. And if they have changed that role and have become an institution in and of itself, they're not really carrying out the original requirement of and mandate is to get others to do what they should be doing in the community. That is their primary focus as a CAP agency. And I don't think you've changed. If you have over the years, then I would say becoming institutionalized, you have left your mission, that a part of what you do is to get others to do for people in poverty and to do those linkages. So you don't have to control the program in order to get those linkages done. So that's a correction I would like to make for this panel. I worked with CAPS for a lot of years. I was on the governor's staff working with community action agencies and with the greater community. So they do a lot more than just confine themselves within their own agency. Am I not correct? If you change that, I would like to know that you have changed your direction and have become an institution in and of yourself.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure that I heard any contradiction between what the two of you said, because I think both of you made significant points about what community-based organizations do. Clearly, if you read our statutes, if you read the community services portions of our statutes, we are an agency focused on persons in poverty. The point is also valid that community-based organizations typically only achieve their work by the same way that we do, by creating partnerships through other organizations in the community, bringing together resources in catalytic ways at the local level. So I didn't actually hear a contradiction there in what both of you said.
I guess one of the concerns is when agencies begin to take on a form and take on the responsibility or assume that responsibility of what some other entity out there in the community should be doing. And part of your function as the State Economic Opportunity Office, or in this case Community Services, is to become a change agent for those entities out there. In fact, that's where you function, at least I know you used to function the best, where you got the banks to really do this kind of thing, and that you're not really the conduit for having all this to happen. And I guess that's what's causing me some concern about this proposal.
Madam Chair, in fact, the way that HB 3600 was implemented was by us being able to, which is the other individual development account bill, that you passed last session, was implemented by us being able to find some discretionary federal dollars that we had and engage through an RFP process, an organization that is able to do the delivery out there. We're not doing it ourselves.
I'm going to have Sheila go through the amendments, but we're not going to move this one today.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have a memo that I did dated June 14th. It talks about three amendments. After I finished that up, last night we got an additional amendment, the Dash 6 amendment, so I'll speak to that one as well. Dash 3 amendment, well, before I get into that, the issues on the bill seem to me to boil down to a couple. One is that this is an existing statute that's in the Commission on Children and Families now. They've not been able to make it happen. And so the proposal is to transfer that to an agency where something potentially could happen with it. Where it's best placed, of course, is a question, and the substantive committee that dealt with this on the House side supported it moving to Housing and Community Services Department, but that is a question. Where's the best placement for this? And then what level of support do you give it if it moves? The governor's budget nor the co-chair's budget at this point identifies resources for this. So what you have in terms of amendments are several choices, if you will. The Dash 3 amendments
in transferring this to the Housing and Community Services Department, adds a language subject to available funding. Then the dash five amendments take out the appropriation language that was originally in the bill. So the dash threes and the dash fives together would make this bill non-fiscal. The dash four amendments that were proposed would establish a work group. As Representative Carlson referenced earlier, there doesn't appear to be a lot of coordination between similar types of programs in various agencies, and this would require Housing and Community Services Department to convene a work group to look at those issues and help assure some coordination. The Dash 4's amendments include an appropriation of $150,000 general fund.
I have a question for the agency. If we approve the Dash 4's, Dash 3, 4's, and 5, and 5 takes out the dollars, would you be able to, within existing resources, coordinate with the other pieces anyway within your existing resources?
Madam Chair, the reason that we have been anxious about the fiscal side of this is that we were not convinced that we could do that. In fact, we're a little nervous about how we're going to, in fact, fund the next biennium's worth of HB 3600 implementation at this point. So we're nervous about that.
So if we pass the amendments, then it would be in the same place that would have occurred with the Commission on Children and Families. That would not, anything would not move forward if we did not give you the $150,000. Is that your response?
Madam Chair, on the surface, it would appear that to be the case. By putting phrasing like subject to available funding in the equation, it does leave the door open for things to happen. For example, and please don't hold me to this 2 years from now, but there is considerable discussion at the federal level on a number of asset building strategies that may result in federal programs occurring. We would still have to come back to you with a proposal at an e-board to actually deploy something in that regard, but having the statute giving us the assignment would clarify who's supposed to be actually following up on that federal legislation. So that's the kind of thing I think that Representative Carlson was trying to respond to.
I think there's two pieces, and I want to get at this, because part of the amendment that Representative Carlson brought forward is the coordination and bringing in those that are not. And that means some meetings with some of the other agencies. Would you need additional dollars just to have those meetings?
Madam Chair, it's been our read that we would, in fact, need to do that, yes.
That you would do that, but I'm asking on the resource side of it.
Correct.
Can you do it without the resource?
I would say no.
Okay. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 6 amendments would do, in fact, what Representative Winters was talking about, would require Housing to coordinate the work group, but does not appropriate money to them.
And they're saying they couldn't do it without the money.
And
children. Thank you. Thank you. I'm closing the hearing on House Bill 2331.
Thank you, ma'am.
Grant application and work session on federal grant requests, Department of Human Services, Office of Children and Families, fetal alcohol syndrome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margie Lau. I'm the Assistant Administrator for Management Operations at the State Office for Services to Children and Families.
The more I learn about state government, the more worried I get.
The proposal in front of you this morning is a request to apply for a grant from the National Centers for Disease Control for the agency to be able to study, and it's a very much a research-based grant, to study what are effective interventions to work with children who have fetal alcohol syndrome. The grant would be for 3 years, and the first year would be for approximately $325,000. The deadline for submitting the grant is June 20th of this year. The grant does not require either state funds or additional position authority to implement. The proposal in the grant is one that would involve a team approach of both parents and professionals working together to develop interventions to help children with this diagnosis to function better within their family and community. It would improve developmental outcomes, we would hope, and also reduce or prevent secondary behavioral characteristics that can cause a lot of disruption in these children's lives. The focus would be to test different interventions with each child with this syndrome to determine which interventions are most effective in dealing with whatever the issues or behaviors are that the child's presenting because of their neurological disorder, and then to train all of the people involved with that child's life on using the same techniques in working with that particular child so that they don't get inconsistent behavioral interventions at school versus from their daycare provider or from their parent or substitute caregiver. We hope that by doing this that we'll be able to maintain more of these children safely within their own families, or if that's not the case, to better prepare them for foster care and adoptive placement, causing fewer placement disruptions for these children. Of the grant, about $250,000 will be used for contracting with a provider. You may recall from the public testimony day for SCF's budget that an organization called Fossets came in and talked about the work that they have been doing funded under System of Care flexible fund dollars to intervene on behalf of these children up in the metropolitan area. About $75,000 of the grant would be used for the research-based component of this. Again, it's the Centers for Disease Control Research Grant. I'd be glad to answer any questions the committee might have.
Ms. Baker.
I'm sorry, Mr. Fazer. Is it Mike or David?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I respond to either, as we've discussed before. For the record, Dave Fazer from DAS Budget Management. We recommend approval of the request.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Legislative Fiscal Office also recommends approval of the request. We note in our analysis that there's a separate fetal alcohol syndrome grant that Health Division and Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs are considering applying for, but the focus of that grant is different. But the agency has assured us that they will be collaborating so that there won't be any overlap in those grants. So we're comfortable with that, and we recommend approval of the application request.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, just a quick question.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Fetal alcohol syndrome, surprisingly, is the most devastating, probably, abuse we have children prior to birth and leaves lifelong neurological damage. Mm-hmm. And some of the other drugs used during pregnancy, meth, cocaine, and even heroin, have less effect on the child long-term, so it's a sort of a misconception of the public of how important this is, and that's something we need to get on the record. My question, though, is one of the problems we face in the medical profession is what's the best treatment for these kids? No one knows for sure. The part I read about that I was most interested in was this is going to be part of a larger national study, and they're going to try to come with outcomes from this that will tell us the best practices as far as treating these children. Is that what I'm reading correctly here?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, yes, that is correct. Although CDC only has the funds to finance 3 research proposals, so we don't know what the level of competition is going to be for this pretty limited resource. But the interventions that we've already funded with both the Flex funds and also with some Office of Child Abuse and Neglect limited grant funds, we think show that this particular treatment intervention process is effective, and we want to be able to use this research grant to really test that more fully to better inform the whole national discussion on fetal alcohol syndrome.
Thank you.
Ms. Baker.
Madam Chair, we recommend approval of the grant application request.
Any objections? No discussion? Senator Yee, you didn't want to say something?
I think it's great.
No, let the record show that Senator Yee says it's great.
I think the fact it's only going to cost us $3 million out of the fund she's interested in is makes it even better.
So there is a difference if it's federal or general fund. But I do think that, those of us who have been concerned about fetal alcohol syndrome, and I think you're getting no disagreement up here on this group. Yeah, I need a motion. I'm sorry. I'm going to hammer it in without a motion.
I'd like to move that the subcommittee approve the submission of the Federal Department of Health and Human Services Centers for Disease Control Prevention grant application amount of $325,000 annually for up to 3 years to identify and evaluate intervention strategies for children with fetal alcohol syndrome.
Representative Schrader moves that we approve the submission of the Federal Department of Human and Health and Human Services grant application in the amount of $325,000 annually for up to 3 years to identify and evaluate intervention strategies for children with fetal alcohol syndrome. Is there any objection? Hearing none. Carrie, you're Senator Yee. You want to take it to full?
Okay. Give us progress.
Madam Chair, if we need to, we will be back for expenditure limitation at an emergency board meeting.
We will be have a session tomorrow. We will convene tomorrow, and we will be working on Saturday. Just so that you know that I don't have the times yet for our sessions, but just keep here.
You be sure to get me the times as soon as you can, because I need an ed sub also Friday or Saturday.
Okay.
Is it morning only?
I'm not certain yet. We don't know yet. We're waiting on our schedule. So with that, any questions, concerns about a weekend?
How about Sunday?
Recommendation?
I haven't been told that I'm to have a session on Sunday.
Make sure it's after church.
After church. I will put that request in that it's after church.
My church is whole day.
With that, we are adjourned.
My church is whole day.